Bolivian climate revolution. From April the 19th to the 22nd, Bolivia hosted the first ever World People's Summit on Climate Change. In this program, I'll be looking at this unique event which brought together governments, indigenous peoples, and activists from all over the world. The UN Summit on Climate Change in Copenhagen last December ended with a bitter dispute over the so-called Copenhagen Accord. By the EU's own admission, the weak agreement, based on voluntary cuts in greenhouse gas emissions, would lead to 4 or more degrees centigrade increase in global temperatures. Here are some of the closing speeches from the Copenhagen conference. First, Barack Obama, then Sudanese negotiator Lumumba Diaping, and finally, UK Climate Secretary Ed Miliband.
The time for talk is over. This is the bottom line. We can embrace this accord, take a substantial step forward, continue to refine it, and build upon its foundation. We can do that, and everyone who is in this room will be part of a historic endeavor, one that makes life better for our children and our grandchildren. Or we can choose delay, falling back into the same divisions that have stood in the way of action for years.
L9 asked Africa to sign a suicide pact, an incineration pact, in order to maintain the economic dominance of few countries.
We have been working for 2 years, Mr. President. We have been working for 2 years. What will the world think of us if after 2 years of work, we simply come out with a document for information? So, Mr. President, I urge you to seek the guidance of this conference and make this a COP decision. Because if we can do that, we can get the money flowing and we can show some credibility to the world. Thank you very much.
Here is writer Naomi Klein's view of the Copenhagen conference.
We did exactly what they said. Temperatures would increase by 3 to 4 degrees Celsius, which would bring on catastrophic climate change. So countries were really negotiating away their own survival. And there has to be an alternative to that. That's just not good enough. And I think it's wonderful that the government of Evo Morales stepped into that disaster and said, come to Cochabamba. We can't afford to lose this battle. This is not about politics. This is not about what is politically feasible. It's about necessity. There has to be an alternative. And that's what this gathering is all about. And when you see the thousands of people who have come here from around the world, it's precisely because we need this as a source of hope. We're not ready to give up. And in Copenhagen, our governments gave up.
Bolivia and several other countries blocked the Copenhagen Accord. 2 weeks later, President Evo Morales announced Bolivia would hold its own summit in Cochabamba. At 2,500 meters altitude, Cochabamba is known as the City of Eternal Spring due to its pleasant climate. Cochabamba is the third city of Bolivia. It has a lively political history as the starting point of the water wars in 2000, when an international conglomerate bought the water supply system. Water prices rose 300 to 400% in some cases. One local man told me it started as a protest, but soon turned into total war. The privatization was finally reversed, and this success helped propel a local senator called Evo Morales to election as Bolivia's first indigenous leader of recent times in 2005. The climate change conference was opened by Compañero Evo himself. Thank you. I'm sitting in the blazing sun on one of the concrete stands in the local football field. On the field in front of me, there are thousands of people in colourful costumes and different types of indigenous dress. Many of them are waving flags. The most common flag I can see is the chequered rainbow flag of the Andean peoples. At the back of the stadium, 100 to 200 soldiers, I would say, in bright red ceremonial dress. Also someone in a funny giant soldier suit. You can hear the music in the background, obviously. Different bands have been coming on. There's people selling all kinds of things, drinks, food. There's a barbecue at one end of the stadium, selling parasols, binoculars. Certainly much more like a music festival than any political meeting I've ever been to. Here is Alicia Bárcena from the UN trying to address the crowd earlier today.
We have come, respectfully, to listen to the people. You have invited us to be here. If you don't want us here, we can go. But I think dialogue between states and people is important. We also represent peoples.
Like many rock stars, Morales came on late. He played up to the crowd of mostly indigenous South American peoples by attacking European and North American culture, speculating that Western diet causes the illness of baldness in Europe. Talking about GM food a lot, he commented that GM food could make all hairdressers in Bolivia go out of business. It would cause so much baldness. He also made comments about chicken from Europe, perhaps turning people gay, and Coca-Cola making you ill. Included an anecdote about cleaning his toilet with Coca-Cola. However, he did finally come round to the topic of climate change.
Sobre todo, pues las causas principal.
The principal cause of the destruction of planet Earth is capitalism.
Y como pueblos que habitamos, que respetamos esta madre tierra.
As people that live on and respect Mother Earth, we have every right to say that the enemy of Mother Earth is capitalism, the capitalist system. It seeks the highest profit possible, promoting limitless growth on a finite planet. However, some countries need a certain degree of improvement. Brothers and sisters, I would say Copenhagen was not a failure for us. It was a triumph for the people and failure for the government of other countries. If these countries had respected the Kyoto Protocol and committed to reducing the emissions within their own borders, this conference would have not been necessary. When I was a kid, I used to go around wearing a poncho. This poncho here is from Tarabuco. It is the poncho that my mother made. Now this poncho is from the West, from capitalism. It is waterproof, but when it breaks, it's useless, and it begins to pollute. So, brothers and sisters, I'm convinced of the importance of remembering the values of the indigenous peasant people and their knowledge for defending Mother Earth. They are small things, but very important. Pachamama or death, we have two paths. Capitalism dies or Mother Earth dies. Capitalism lives, or Mother Earth lives. Of course, brothers and sisters, we are for humanity and for the rights of Mother Earth.
Bolivia has had its share of contentious political leaders. In Tarata, on the outskirts of Cochabamba, I saw a statue of Mariano Margarejo, who was president of Bolivia from 1865 to 1871. He actually gave away a large part of the country to Brazil in exchange for a magnificent white horse. Anyway, back to the conference. Panel debates were an opportunity to discuss solutions to climate change. This is head of Friends of the Earth International, Nemo Bassi.
There is a solution that does not require technology transfer. It is not speculative. It is foolproof and will not fail. Simple. All we are demanding, and we're saying this in Nigeria. I've heard it said in the Yasuni, I'm sure you're going to hear about it in Ecuador. I've heard it said in the Lotofan area of nowhere in Europe. Simple solution. Leave the crude oil in the soil. Leave the coal in the hole and leave the tar sand in the land where Mother Earth kept it.
Surprisingly, NGOs are not the only ones proposing such radical ideas.
My name is Maria Fernandez Pinoza. I am the Minister of Cultural and Natural Heritage of Ecuador.
What is this groundbreaking proposal that Ecuador is putting forward?
Well, basically the government of Ecuador has decided to not exploit 20% of the reserves of oil that are located within a national park with one of the highest biodiversity in the entire planet and also the home of indigenous peoples in voluntary isolation. The government of Ecuador has decided to leave underground close to 900 million barrels of oil, and in that way, not only conserving biodiversity, preserving the home of indigenous peoples on voluntary isolation, but also avoiding emissions for 400 million metric tons of CO2 to the atmosphere. So in doing that, we are contributing to prevent climate change.
Wow. Okay, so how long are you committed to leaving this all under the ground for? Is there a time limit on this?
Well, I think it now depends on the international community, because in exchange we are requesting compensation. And compensation for the 50% of the present value of the oil.
So only 50% of the value?
Yes, we are. Ecuador is providing the other 50% as a contribution to Mother Earth and to combat climate change. So here we are talking about $7 billion, and we are requesting the international community contribution for at least $3,500 million. So $3.5 billion in exchange, and Ecuador is contributing 50%.
So would this be something you'd be proposing at the next United Nations Climate Summit?
Yes, let's hope. I mean, this is a formula that Ecuador is putting forward, but that is not entirely part of the climate negotiations, because it is outside of the Kyoto Protocol scheme and also of the convention on the convention content. This is something new, this is something different that works parallel to the efforts of the Climate Change Convention and the Kyoto Protocol.
Do you think initiatives like this can really break the deadlock that that is now facing the international climate change negotiations?
We really hope so. We really hope so, because it proposes a different north-south, south-north cooperation in terms of climate change, a new scheme for co-responsibility. It is also proposing to keep a highly biodiverse forest in place and prevent deforestation. And it is also proposing a connection between the rights of indigenous peoples and conservation purposes. So it is a multidimensional proposal, and we expect that these are the issues that are going to be considered in future agreements within the Convention on Climate Change and the post-Kyoto arrangements.
Conference participants were split between 17 working groups, roughly mirroring the UN process, discussing topics such as carbon markets, technology transfer, and structural causes of climate change. However, leaving oil in the soil wasn't on the agenda in Bolivia, according to a group which set up an 18th working group in a nearby restaurant under heavy police vigilance. Mesa 18, or Group 18, wanted to discuss the political reality of fossil fuel and mineral extraction in Bolivia. They said despite Morales' rhetoric of Mother Earth rights, they've been badly affected by big mining projects and hydroelectric dams which have flooded their valleys.
I'm Pablo Regalski from the Senda Institution, Centro de Comunicación y Desarrollo Andino in Cochabamba.
Okay, excellent. And I believe you've been involved in setting up a working group here in the outside the conference.
Yes, well, this workshop, in fact, is the result of the CONAMAC organization, who asked for extending the discussion to the issue of collective rights. And this was not taken into account by the government. And that's why we tried to make this dialogue with the conference and within the conference, but we had to stay a little bit outside of the conference because this was not officially authorized. But anyway, all the people who are taking part in this workshop are official members of the official conference, World Conference for Climate Change.
Could you just explain briefly, if you can, what collective rights means for an audience that might not know?
Well, it's not easy to say it in a few words, but means that the indigenous rights are consider themselves as a nation. So they ask not only for individual rights, but as be recognized as a nation and to be considered as having collective rights. For example, to be consulted, to have the right to self-determination, to have the right to self-government, and this self-government to be conducted under their own rules, which means they have the right to write their own rules and define their own rules for governing themselves, and that's why there are all these conflicts within indigenous territories, because these are the conflicts between the national law, for example, the mining code, which is a little bit old, it's 20 years old, and the right to self-government, which is a legal right. Since the constitution, a new constitution, came to force 1 year ago.
Okay, that's really interesting. I've noticed that a lot of the conversations in the workshop have been around mining and extractive projects and dams and things like that. Is that something which is in conflict to the rest of the conference, perhaps?
Well, the rest of the conference is oriented to define what they will ask the governments, which will meet in Mexico next year, or the end of this year. So the government wanted to reduce the discussion to the question of reducing the level of gases or emission of gases emission, and to discuss the question of the climate debt and the institution of a climate justice tribunal. And we wanted to not only to discuss that, which we also want to support this governmental aim, but also we wanted to discuss the model of the new model of development, which the indigenous movements or the indigenous people wanted to develop to enforce, and that's why, and because so many people came to Bolivia for this conference, and these people came to Bolivia not for any reason, but because they think in Bolivia there is a new model, development model. Beginning and to life, and so what we wanted to understand is what the problems we have in putting in this new model to work, and all the conflicts around the between this new model and the old model, the capitalist extractivist model.
Because I guess that. I guess that one issue is that with although Bolivia is a very progressive country, which is doing a lot to explore a new model, its economy is still quite dependent on fossil fuel extraction.
Of course, it's part of the transition, but that's the reason why we have to examine very closely these problems and to understand how we will overcome these conflicts. Because otherwise, if we don't discuss it, the multinationals, they have the means and the power to overcome us. And so we have to be very conscious of all the obstacles that we confront at this stage.
Excellent. Anything else you'd like to add that's happened in the last few days that you found interesting?
Well, of course, the success of this government and this new model depends on the world solidarity. And what I want to stress is that this solidarity is not just with one government, but it's the solidarity with the indigenous movements who put this government in office. And what we try to stress is that the movement is the force of the movement is based on the force of the indigenous movement and not exactly on the force of the state.
Mesa 18 also aimed to highlight the ongoing protest at the San Cristobal silver, lead and zinc mine. Local peasants in the Potosí region seized control of parts of the mine and blockaded the roads and railways, demanding compensation for the environmental damage and local control over the resources. One of the participants in the group told me that they are talking about Mother Earth's rights, but the reality is very different. Next, we look at the ideas of climate debt and the climate tribunal, which are both being hotly discussed here in Cochabamba.
My name's Matthew Stillwell, and I work for the Institute for Governance and Sustainable Development.
What are the main sort of principles that outline climate debt as an idea?
So the basic concept of climate debt is that those who are wealthy and have caused climate change owe a responsibility to compensate those who are poor and who suffer the effects of climate change. If you have an obligation to compensate or to help or to assist and you fail to fulfill that obligation, you have a debt. So the concept itself is quite simple. It's a concept that everybody from a head of state to a poor villager understands, and it's a way of thinking about climate change that changes the dynamic and the discourse to one that's more focused on justice.
So I guess instead of countries trying to fight over the amount of emissions they can get away with, they're instead looking at what's right and wrong.
That's exactly right. And so it's a way of putting the issue back in context. right? That there's been a historical process that's caused climate change, that those who are wealthy have become wealthy in part because they've profited from cheap carbon growth, right? We've externalized our costs to the atmosphere, as economists would say, and not just to the atmosphere, but to Bolivia, to, you know, many African countries, to many of the small island states, right? Those countries are now suffering because we've prospered from digging carbon from under the ground and ejecting it into the atmosphere.
Yes, my name is Beverly Keane, and I'm here as part of the delegation from Jubilee South, which is a network of social movements, organizations, campaigns in Latin America, Africa, and Asia that struggle against debt domination. And that for us includes looking at the issues of ecological debt and, of course, climate debt.
Okay, so I know you've done a workshop here on the possibility of a climate tribunal. Could you just describe that concept for us here?
There is a tremendous sense of injustice that is felt, and most communities don't find that in the judicial systems in their own countries, in the judicial systems in our regional levels, or certainly at an international level, we're not finding redress. And so this notion of constituting people's tribunals, opinions where people themselves, movements and organizations can come together and in a sense look at the evidence, hear what's happening, evaluate that evidence, and evaluate on the basis of what are the rights that we claim as persons, as communities, as peoples, and what are the rights that we claim also for Mother Earth, for nature. And if we see that those rights are being violated, to use the format of a tribunal as an ethical, as a judicial, not as a judicial barrier, but as a legal, in a sense, tribunal, as a political expression of what we as people's movements understand to be justice. So it's a case of, in a sense, using a form, particular kind of form, to open opportunities for communities affected by the realities of climate change, affected by the realities of ecological injustice, to really be able to speak out, to name the problem, to look at the evidence, to identify who's responsible, and also to be very clear about what are the kinds of sanctions that we want to take place.
So this concept of a climate tribunal would be both for sort of reparations for damage caused by climate change, and also to stop polluting behavior by corporations and countries, am I right?
Exactly. I think most movements, and certainly here in Cochabamba, we've heard it in almost all of the different working groups and the various activities and the panels, that the notion of climate justice has to do indeed with restoring equilibrium to Mother Earth. So the tribunal, in a sense, is seen as a way of helping to identify what needs to happen for that kind of equilibrium to be restored, for that kind of balance to be restored.
So, just briefly, I'm quite interested in that concept of identifying the cause of climate change and also the effect of it, because that is a very difficult thing. I mean, you know, many scientists will refuse to name any particular effect as specifically a climate-related or climate change-related effect. And likewise, how do you pin the blame on specific individuals, companies, or nations when it's talking about 200 years of fossil fuels?
You're right, that is a huge challenge. But what is sometimes difficult in the specific case is much easier if we look at the aggregate. And there are very few scientists who would not be willing to say that the problem of climate change has to do with the enormous consumption of fossil fuels, for instance. Deforestation that has to do oftentimes with also the use of fossil fuels or sustaining modes of production and modes of consumption that mean today, you know, the ecological footprint of your average person, as it were, in the north, is 10 times what very grossly inflated averages in the South. Even as the United Nations recognized in 1992, so almost 20 years ago, that there is a differential responsibility that's been accepted by the industrialized countries of the North in the way that atmospheric space, natural resources have been used, have been abused disproportionately. If we look even at international law, existing international law, if we look at the treaties that these countries even themselves have signed, the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change was signed by the United States in 1992 and a whole lot of other countries, and it establishes their responsibility and they commit themselves in an obligation, a legal obligation, to provide the resources, to provide the technology that is needed throughout the South in order to ensure, in a sense, that countries can develop, that they have the space to do that. That means that there are reductions in emissions in the North. They free up atmospheric space for the countries of the South to be able to develop, and also, in a sense, to be able to prevent and to provide for, in a sense, the consequences of the impacts of climate change that are going to come, whatever is done today, because of the buildup that's already there in the atmosphere.
The UN process could be a way of sliding the tribunal idea into the international institutions.
That's one possibility, and certainly there's a lot of debate about that within even the process that we've had just getting off the ground of the tribunal, of People's Tribunal on Climate Justice. A lot of discussion about building an international tribunal within the UN system. I think what many of the movements and organizations here in Cochabamba would say very clearly, that certainly there's a lot of question about the capacity of the UN system to really deliver. I don't think many people question the basic idea of a multilateral system and a system that incorporates all countries on an equal basis. But looking at reality, most of us are saying that that's not really what happens. But an initiative like the People's Tribunal on climate justice and ecological debt, one of the things that we've been saying very clearly is that we need to use existing law. And we need to recognize that there's a lot of existing law at the national level, at regional levels, at international levels, that is, in a sense, that defends our rights, that expresses and reflects the rights of people and even the rights of nature. It needs to be developed much further. But clearly the most important challenge is to really to enforce it, to put it into practice.
Something else which was widely discussed was the Copenhagen Accord. Here is Ecuadorian Culture Minister Maria Fernandez Espinosa talking about her country's experience.
Les quiero contar una cosa. La semana pasada, los Estados Unidos le suspendió al Ecuador.
I would like to tell you something. Last week, the United States suspended climate change assistance intended for Ecuador. Funds of $2.5 million, because Ecuador didn't sign up to the Copenhagen Accord. This is the United States punishing Ecuador for not signing this so-called agreement, which was not even an agreement. It was a spurious document written by a few countries without consulting people or governments of the world. Ecuador will not accept this type of blackmail. In fact, the president of Ecuador and the people of Ecuador have said with total seriousness, Ecuador offers the United States $2.5 million in aid if the United States signs the Kyoto Protocol.
Throughout the conference, working groups discussed various areas. Here is Michael Johnson from New York, who led the Harmony with Nature working group.
It was like everything else. It's hard when you're dealing with a group of people, because we were individuals coming together to try to come up with a consensus of an idea of a working product. So it takes a great deal of effort, because you have to give everyone an opportunity to speak. It's a democracy. We want people to have an opportunity to come up and speak about what their important issues are. They have to be listened to, considered, and then we try to melt it into one product. So it was difficult, but we came together in love and harmony. you know? So it's
harmony. That's the theme of the group.
Exactly. The name of the group is what we had to do. We had to do what we were planning on putting forth as a project, which is harmony with ourselves and with nature and with all things living. We had a format which pretty much came organically through the participation of the people involved in our working group, and we just had to form to meet their needs, to be able to speak and find a true consensus. All we had to do is give them the avenue to do so.
All right. Do you think you're successful with this process?
Definitely. It was a major undertaking. We accomplished it, and I think it was only true to the testament of each individual participant.
What would you say to people who say that, you know, getting several hundred people in a room together from all over the world, and they ask them what they think of abstract theme, there's a danger of making something kind of meaningless because everyone's got a different idea?
Correct. And that's why we identified a problem. We solely worked on trying to identify a solution. And of course, there were circumstances when things were going off in different directions, and that's why it was my responsibility and my co-president's responsibility to kind of rein it in and make sure we stayed on task, because we had to be really keen on what we're trying to do and make sure we can have some concrete concrete resolution that we can adapt that would be a foundation, not answer all the issues specifically, but a foundation in which to build off of.
So what's the next step?
The next step is minimizing our entire document to be incorporated into all the 17 groups document that will then be put forth as a declaration.
Not all groups were so harmonious, however. Some spent days arguing over certain points. For example, the group discussing strategies for action spent a long time arguing over the location of the next conference.
The final declaration for the conference was ambitious, to say the least. It called for a complete rejection of the Copenhagen Accord, instead asking for a new commitment period for the Kyoto Protocol between 2013 and 2017. Within these 5 years, it says, developed countries should reduce their emissions by 50%, thus keeping global temperatures below 1 degree warming average and reducing emissions in the atmosphere to 300 parts per million. They're currently at 391 parts per million, so this is a significant challenge.
It also demands financing for poorer countries equivalent to 6% of rich countries' GDP. Another notable area from the final declaration was a complete rejection of RED, the UN scheme to generate carbon credits from forestry activities. Many indigenous peoples have accused the scheme of excluding them from using the forests, or even paying companies to chop down ancient forests and then replace them with monoculture plantations. In the end, 57 countries' official delegations participated, along with over 30,000 people from 142 different countries, according to the conference organizers.
Hello, my name is Brad Garness. I am an indigenous Alaskan. I am a member of the Samish Indian Nation, and I have come here to help educate and discuss the effects of climate change and how they are affecting my people in Alaska. Well, last year, I went to New York City during the International Security Summit for the United Nations, and I met with Evo Morales. And my tribes, they gave me a gift to bring to Evo, and that gift was a wolf's tail. And in tribal memory, a wolf's tail has great meaning, because the story is that in olden times, the animals stole fire from God and gave it to man because he was cold. This is a tribal, much like Prometheus stole fire from the gods. All the animals that helped the indigenous people were burned, and so their hair is both black and white. The wolf helped, where like Brown Bear did not help. He is not black and white. This wolf's tail is a metaphor, because it is enlightenment, it's a knowledge. And so we brought a wolf's tail that was on fire to Evo from Shishmaref. Shishmaref is one of the communities that is falling into the ocean. Last year, I helped my people move a village called Nutok. We moved 700 people who've lived in this village since the beginning of time. And now they are forced to assimilate into Western culture. We lose our traditions, we lose our cultures, and we lose our values.
and our people are being absorbed into imperialist capitalism.
My name is Yudhvir Singh. I'm from India. My organization is Indian Farmers Union and is a member of La Via Campesina International. Yeah, basically we are here. All Via Campesina delegates from all over the continents, we are here and we are trying to find out a way how to protect the planet, how to save the planet. Because this conference is a difference, totally different from the previous conferences organized by, like in Copenhagen and other places. But they just eye-washed. They are not doing anything. Practically, there's nothing. They are just facilitating the agribusiness people and like, and we don't have any hope from them. So this is a good idea. Now we are here, and this conference is by the people and for the people. So now we are here, and we are discussing, and we are trying to find out the solution, how we can save this planet.
That's the sound of a helicopter passing overhead. I wonder who it could be inside. It's a good chance it could be someone who's come to speak tomorrow at the meeting of peoples and governments. Hugo Chavez from Venezuela closed the conference in front of 20,000 people in Cochabamba's main football stadium.
I will finish by talking about the crisis. That is a lot more than the climate. It is political, moral, ethical, and ideological. The true solution, the true path to escape chaos, as Che said, the infinite Che, he said it's necessary to get one or two steps ahead of the chaos. I believe our countries, Bolivia, Ecuador, Cuba and Venezuela, Nicaragua, we are ahead of the chaos. That does not mean we are not threatened by the chaos. I believe we have taken several steps now towards socialism.
Que trasciende a Cuba, que trasciende a Bolivia, que trasciende a Venezuela, que trasciende a Ecuador.
It is now an international project that goes beyond our countries.
El socialismo. Y una crisis también, como dice el mismo Fidel, de ideas.
This is also a crisis, as compañero Evo said, of ideas. Someone was speaking of the perfect storm. All the crises concentrated in one.
Saldrá, sin duda,
but out of this great crisis, we will emerge, burying imperialism and a new living order within the world we have fought for and dreamt of for so long. I do not have the slightest doubt. We need to win, and we will win, but we need to give it all our strength. And this is why the conference Evo has created is so important.
Although Chavez and Morales certainly have a point when they say rich countries do not examine the causes of climate change, laying the blame solely on capitalism also seems slightly meaningless. I suppose it is easier for Chavez to accuse imperialist capitalism rather than fossil fuels when Venezuela is one of the biggest oil exporters in the world. Perhaps more dialogue is needed between different points of view to find a true solution to climate change. In her closing address, one of the UN representatives admitted that there was a need for more dialogue between peoples and governments and the UN, which is undoubtedly a good outcome from this conference. The day after the conference,
local newspapers were reporting that the government had proposed Evo Morales for a Nobel Peace Prize. We'll have to see what happens. He has been proposed for the prize before, but with no success. Anyway, there are plans to hold another summit next year. Perhaps I'll see you there. Before I go, I asked Bert from Climate Justice Action what he had planned over the next year.
We've been doing two main things. Firstly, we've been working towards a workshop, which is a participatory workshop, where we've been trying to get people's opinions and understand how people are active on climate justice at the moment, what struggles people face. And then we've been trying to link these struggles and work towards a global day of action for the 12th of October. The 12th of October is significant because it's historically been imposed as Columbus Day. And two years ago, a collective from across Latin America called Global Minga called for a day of action, reclaiming this day as a day for climate justice, Mother Earth. And so in Europe, CJ, we've reacted to this call and we're trying to mobilise for a global day of action for climate justice and system change, not climate change. So we've been here for the week really building connections, hearing stories and working out how we can build these movements over the next 6 months and really make some form of impact.
Do you think that the different framings of climate change are insurmountably different? I mean, you've got a very spiritualist view of Mother Earth, and in Europe we traditionally have a very technocratic scientific idea of it. Do you think you can reconcile those two?
Yeah, I don't think that's really a difference there, or rather the differences are superficial, which is that we're part of global systems and that manifests itself differently. So the conditions, the actual existing conditions of somebody in Bolivia, for instance, who might be facing huge water shortages, either through the melting of glaciers or through the privatised companies that are looking for profit. Whether it be those people or whether it be people who are actually fighting from a scientific basis, the reality of what we're caught up in is the same, and it's the same systems that we're needing to struggle against. So for all of the differences, we don't want to reduce them, and we mustn't reduce them down to a single struggle. That's quite important. Rather, what we need to do is find how all of these differences resonate, and that's really healthy. And a movement, or rather movement of movements, relies on these differences. It relies on different experiences, different understandings, and different solutions in terms of how we can take stuff forward. So yes, there are differences, but we must always look beyond them to understand what holds us together. Anyone that wants to get involved, wants to be part of this, you can check out the Climate Justice Action website, which is climate-justice-action.org. Get on there, get in contact with us, and we'll find a way to network together.
You can hear this program again at climateradio.org. This program was researched, produced, and edited by me, Arthur Gerling. Thanks also to Guillermo Rubens, Ed Baxter, Phil England, and Onita Asadullah.